Hello and welcome to Burst CME. On behalf of Physicians Education Resource, thank you for joining us. I am Dr. Mark Ogolnik. I'm a medical oncologist with a focus on bone and soft tissue sarcomas at Keck Medicine of USC in Los Angeles, California. I'd like to welcome Daniel Leffler, who's joining me today. Dr. Leffler, could you please introduce yourself?
My name is Dan Leffler. I am a medical oncologist at the University of Pennsylvania, where I'm the associate clinical director of sarcoma medical oncology here. It's nice to join you.
Thank you so much for joining us. During this program, we will utilize an interactive case-based format to discuss recognizing the signs and symptoms of epithelioid sarcoma and choosing the most appropriate therapy based on the clinical scenario in order to help clinicians identify best practices in the diagnosis and management of epithelioid sarcoma to improve outcomes for patients with this rare soft tissue sarcoma subtype. This will provide insight into integrating these strategies into clinical practice. Dr. Leffler and I will now present a patient case for discussion and talk through the clinical decision points for a patient with epithelioid sarcoma. So SA is a 24-year-old man who presents with a history of a slow enlarging mass on the medial aspect of his forearm near the wrist. Initially presumed to be a lipoma, the lesion gradually increased in size and became uncomfortable. MRI of the region demonstrates a well-defined soft tissue nodule within the subcutaneous tissues, measuring up to 4.4 centimeters. Subsequent biopsy confirms a diagnosis of epithelioid sarcoma. A PET scan reveals an FDG avid mass at the primary site, an ipsilateral, mildly hypermetabolic, minimally enlarged axillary lymph nodes measuring up to 1.4 centimeters. There is no evidence of distant metastatic disease, and results of routine laboratory investigations, including a complete blood count and metabolic panel, are within normal limits. So Dan, I guess the first question would be, is what is the most appropriate next step in the management of SA's condition?
It sounds like the patient has had an appropriate workup and with both staging imaging and a biopsy proving their disease. A PET scan is appropriate for staging, and I wouldn't necessarily pursue further staging imaging for the patient. And the biopsy shows a definitive answer. And so the only question then is, what are these somewhat questionable axillary lymph nodes? And so what I would choose to do in this situation is recommend referral to a surgical oncologist familiar with sarcoma and resect the primary tumor with axillary lymph node dissection or with biopsy to ascertain if the disease is there as well. Epithelioid sarcoma is one of the few sarcomas that can metastasize to regional lymph nodes prior to more disseminated metastases. And so investigating these questionable nodes is really important. It can be both diagnostic in terms of staging the patient pathologically, as well as potentially therapeutic as well.
When you think about all of these staging tests, we don't always do PET scans, sometimes we do CT scans. If you were to discuss this with a referring doctor and they would say, where is the most likely site that you're going to see metastatic disease, what would you discuss with them?
Yeah, so in the majority of sarcomas, the lungs are the most common place to have metastases. Soft tissue sarcomas, as well as bone sarcomas, most frequently metastasize to the lung, and national guidelines support scanning the lungs as the primary site when you are obtaining staging imaging for a patient. It is rare, but with certain subtypes, you can have disease in other places, such as regional lymph nodes in this case, as well as other rare sarcoma subtypes like angiosarcoma and rhabdomyosarcoma. And that's why getting a sense for that is important. But in this case, at least with the tumor where it is, a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis probably could also catch the axillary lymph nodes, and you might see it there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. It really does hone down for those of us in sarcoma, and we live in this world where we're so focused on histology. Histology does drive our our staging scans and how we see these patients, because you're nailing it exactly. You need to know the subtypes because all sarcomas don't go to certain areas. And so the need for a brain MRI is restricted to certain subtypes. The need to look at lymph nodes is restricted to certain subtypes. And so there really is this keen need to understand all these nuances to fully adequately stage our patients and understand how to predict patterns of recurrences and patterns of spread. So for this patient, the patient does undergo resection of the primary tumor with lymph node dissection. The tumor does get fully excised with negative margins, but two of the eight lymph nodes are positive for sarcoma. He begins imaging surveillance, which shows no evidence of disease for 9 months. However, a follow-up CT scan at that time revealed over 10 pulmonary nodules that measure up to 2 centimeters in size and a recurrence of the primary tumor at the surgical scar. A transbronchial biopsy confirms metastatic epithelioid sarcoma. So after confirming a diagnosis of epithelioid sarcoma, what is your approach to patients like this? What is your thinking when you see an epithelioid sarcoma? It is very rare. We don't see them that often. So walk me through how you approach this.
Yeah, so the patient had appropriate management of their limited stage disease, although with lymph node metastases, obviously they had regional disease. Afterwards, there's always a conversation about whether adjuvant chemotherapy can be considered or adjuvant radiotherapy. And in this case, they were not done. I would say that adjuvant chemotherapy can be a bit of a debate in the sarcoma world and a hotly debated topic at that. And so this patient was appropriately started on surveillance afterwards with imaging. When this patient represented, it sounds like they had biopsy-proven metastatic disease. So widespread disease, meaning the tumor is now in multiple places and presumably is systemic, having metastasized, probably hematologically. In that situation, you have to match the disease with the you have to match the treatment to the disease in terms of where it is. And so systemic disease equals systemic treatment. And so with all patients, it is recommended to consider a clinical trial. And then if there is no clinical trial available to the patient, initiating some kind of systemic therapy, whether it is chemotherapy or targeted therapy or immunotherapy, is dependent again on things like the histologic subtype and the patient who's in front of you. Things such as other localized therapies like radiation or surgery could be considered if there's just a local recurrence or maybe an oligometastasis, although again, that's sometimes a bit controversial and very much is dependent on a case-by-case basis. But in this situation, there are multiple areas of disease requiring treatment with something that goes into the whole system.
When you think about sarcoma, so I always think you need to approach them all differently, as we discussed before. So when I look at clinical trials and I sit in front of my patients, I sort of look, is the clinical trial specifically for sarcoma? Is the clinical trial specifically for your histology of sarcoma? And is your clinical trial phase three, two, or one? And I sort of break it down in those regards because I certainly think coming into a late in development phase three clinical trial gives the most likelihood that drug will be effective and versus. What is your approach when you're sitting down with patients? Let's say you had three different trials for them. How do you approach a sarcoma patient with a clinical trial roster that potentially allows them several trials to be engaged in?
Mark, if I had three clinical trials for my sarcoma patients at all times, that would be a wonderful thing.
Let's pretend you do.
I would love to have that option, and I think we should all work towards that. That's a very, very good point. And I agree, the number of trials that go from phase one that are potentially scientifically promising to phase two, where they've had some defined safety data, so you know that you're not only scientifically approaching the patients correctly and the disease correctly, but you also know that it's relatively safe to do for the patients. And then phase three, you get obviously attrition at each step, finding out if a therapy is effective or not. And so I agree with you. If I had my druthers and I had all phase one, two, and three in front of me, and that there was a trial specifically for a patient and their disease, and that I would choose something like that that has a little bit more backing behind it. But often we are in the situation where, especially for rare tumors like sarcomas, We have to choose based on biomarkers and the disease-specific considerations themselves, and often those patients end up in basket phase one trials that are biomarker-based. However, the more data behind, the more evidence behind a choice in a clinical trial, the more attractive I think it is for a patient, and more, higher likelihood I think there is of success in controlling their disease or making them better as well.
So if I were to say this patient began systemic therapy specifically tailored to treat his recurrent metastatic epithelioid sarcoma, the reason I would say that is because exactly what you just said. There was a basket trial, and there was a trial that looked at patients with epithelioid sarcomas who specifically fell into the basket because of a specific marker. So talk to me a little bit about what we know on a molecular level about epithelioid sarcomas, because this is has essentially changed the way we treat our patients. And this is probably the biggest advancement in this disease in a long time.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of amazing what we can do with targeted therapies when we understand the disease better. And epithelioid sarcoma is kind of the a great it's a great example of that. The there's a big basket trial using a drug called tazemetostat, which inhibits a molecule called EZH2. And in this basket trial, because of the molecular basis for epithelioid sarcoma, there was a cohort of patients with epithelioid sarcoma who received the drug, and there, it showed some promising results. Epithelioid sarcoma is, in most cases, defined by either a loss of INI1, which is a protein, or a deletion of SMARCB1, which is the gene correlate. Often, interestingly, these things are not necessarily correlated, and you can have INI1 loss without the gene being deleted, which is thought to be related to other genetic expressing modifications. But many epithelioid sarcomas are defined by these findings, whether it's INI1 or SMARCB1. And so that protein changes how genes are expressed on a very high level. This is through silencing of chromatin. And because you lose a protein that is part of this regulatory process in silencing chromatin, you get a lot more silencing of chromatin, a lot more gene underexpression. And so the idea is if you can make that work more normally, you can then have genes expressed more normally, and the tumors don't act as, or the genetic changes aren't acting as oncogenic. And so tazemetostat blocks EZH2, which is part of this process, to try and recreate the genetic expression of a more normal cell and thus be an anti-neoplastic agent. The results of this basket trial showed positive responses in the epithelioid sarcoma cohort, which biologically makes sense based on what I just talked about, and so was promising to move forward in these patients.
Yeah, it was certainly an exciting time. So I was fortunate enough and fortunate for my patients to be able to be involved in this study. The epithelioid group was cohort number 5 of several different cohorts. And essentially between December of 2015 through July of 2017, 62 patients were enrolled in this study. And they did find that 9 patients did have an objective response rate, which gave a response rate of about 15%, 15%. And at a median follow-up, the median progression-free survival was 5.5 months, and median overall survival was 19 months. Talk to me a little bit when you use this drug or read about this drug. How do you counsel a patient with respect to tolerability? This is clearly not chemotherapy. The side effect profile is very different. This is probably even a side effect profile that's very different than other targeted therapies that we use. So talk a little bit about how you approach with respect to side effect profile.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is that that response rate is relatively comparable to the existing drugs that we have, which are traditional cytotoxic chemotherapies, which can obviously be quite toxic to patients. In addition to being cytotoxic to the tumors, they can come with a lot of side effects and include a lot of side effects that patients honestly fear because of stigma with chemotherapy. And so to have a comparable finding there and some of the promising clinical results in this trial is very promising and understandably appealing to patients. In terms of the side effect profile and what I counsel patients on, this has come up actually a couple of times in the last month, interestingly, despite being such a rare disease. The primary things that I talk to patients about and were borne out in the trial as well are some GI toxicities, as well as hematologic toxicities, such as anemia, low white counts, and low platelets. The fatigue that accompanies the anemia might be another thing that is worth highlighting. And those are the things that I definitely talk to patients about the most, especially in patients who have been pre-treated with chemotherapy. I do talk to them because their blood counts might be low to begin with, and thus tolerating this drug might be a little bit tougher than starting it in the front line. And so I do talk to them about that consideration as well, because sometimes these patients, you know, can and do receive tazemetostat in the first line before they receive any treatment. And sometimes they receive it after they've already received some treatment for their epithelial sarcoma. And that is a consideration in terms of the side effect profile. I'm interested in your own experience with it.
So I actually have found, I think there was a lot of excitement when the original trial happened, because there were a lot of patients that came from different places of the country, specifically seeking a trial, and was very relieved to know that there was something that's targeted versus what traditionally they would do, like the doxorubicin-based therapies, the ifosfamide, things like that. The tolerability is quite remarkable. And I do think that even in pre-treated patients, we still see a degree of tolerability that is better than what traditionally we would see with other chemo. I do agree the anemia, potentially weight loss, were the two major grade 3 toxicities that we saw in this study that potentially have some impact for people. But generally, I think everyone would agree this is much easier to tolerate than other drugs that we potentially could be using.
I think that one thing that's worth highlighting is the difference in quality of life that's not necessarily measured by the fact that somebody can take a pill rather than get an infusion once every 3 weeks or so with traditional cytotoxic chemotherapies. And, you know, the quality of life aspect of, you know, keeping your hair, if the chemotherapy would cause you to lose your hair, for instance, which we do see quite a bit with our regimens, that is something that I think people feel when they're talking about a drug and the treatment of their cancer, and is a something about identifying as a cancer patient that's worth mentioning, because maybe it is a little bit more humanizing to have something that's more tolerable and doesn't necessarily make you look like somebody who has cancer as well, for whatever it's worth.
Correct. And I think it's worth something, because these are tend to be patients that are younger. And because we're demographing younger, if you think that the average sarcoma patient is 62, this is certainly not the average sarcoma patient. What resources do you have at your center for younger patients that will help them get through a process like this?
We have a wonderful network of people who I wish I could take credit for, but it's all their work, such as a nurse navigator, as well as nutritionists, and other folks who are there to support these patients in their journey. I think that because many of the sarcomas, like epithelial sarcomas, do skew younger, our team on the sarcoma side is much more adept at helping those patients navigate the process and understanding the side effects and the journey specific to their experience, as opposed to maybe other disease sites. So especially our navigation services is something that has really been built out very recently, that I have seen patients really benefit from as well. We also have a close relationship nicely with our pediatric hospital here. And I think that those kinds of relationships, especially understanding these transitions in age and transitions of care, really do help patients if you on the healthcare side have good relationships across, in our case, it's across the street, but obviously across a city or wherever else it is.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly highlights that young patients really need to be tapped into a network that's often driven by social workers that have a very keen understanding of the adolescent, young adult experience and what is potentially available to them. Because I think some of the group sessions are wonderful for them. I think it addresses issues that potentially are not the same issues for a 70-year-old cancer patient. So issues with respect to potentially self-esteem, libido, sexual relationships, things like that, discussing family planning, all very important for this patient population. I also think they do have resources that, unless you're hooked into these major academic centers that have the multidisciplinary teams that do include your social workers and your adolescent young adult groups and palliative care and all those things, there are sometimes summer experiences, there are hiking experience, camping, canoeing experiences that these patients could go together, and then they get this sense of community. I often say to the patient, ask them what their experience is like sitting in the waiting room, because when they sit in the waiting room, I often, because they look so good compared, because they're often on these oral agents, most people in the waiting room would assume that their parent who comes with them is the patient and that the child is not the patient, just based on their age. So it does take a toll on people. So I do think tapping into these AYA programs is imperative here.
On the flip side of that also, for my patients who I have had transitions with our pediatric hospital, because they have bridged that pediatric adult divide, I have heard it interesting about sitting in a pediatric oncology practice waiting room and being the oldest person there by maybe a good clip sometimes, and how, you know, like the assumptions can then be flipped around in the same way that you're pointing out. And so it can be hard no matter what part of that process you're in and what side of things you're on. And so I think that you make a really good point about supporting these patients is a very specific, specialized and very important thing.
So tapping into the emotional aspects of treating sarcoma patients, which is difficult given the age, walk me through your personal sense when you're approaching a patient using a drug like tazemetostat versus talking to someone about doxorubicin. How does that make you feel? Because I think a lot of these drugs that we start to have bring a sense of excitement because it is easier to offer patients drugs that we perceive to be easier for them. So talk to me a little bit about that.
I think there is a degree of excitement. I think that even like the word targeted therapy sounds a lot nicer and more exciting than chemotherapy, which has a big, as I said before, a big stigma to it. And I think that's true for the patients, but is equally true for us, you know, as scientists, as people who try to enroll patients on trials and design the next treatments. That's what we want to believe is the next step forward. And obviously these targeted treatments are designed to target cancer and not necessarily as much the patient. And I think that that's true in many ways, but might undersell a little bit, you know, sometimes what symptoms could be. I am always happy when I get to talk about a targeted therapy for a patient because there's still fewer than the cytotoxic chemotherapies that I have to offer. And in the majority of cases, I'm always offering chemotherapy, and that comes with a lot of baggage. And so in situations with like epithelioid sarcoma, when I see a patient, it is exciting. And it's good to be able to offer a patient something that is more humanizing, has maybe fewer side effects, is pretty well tolerated despite some side effects. And so emotionally, you know, I feel that for sure, but I don't want to oversell any like effectiveness. It's not going to shrink everybody's tumor, obviously, with a decent response rate by our standards, but, you know, things can always be improved. And so the hope is that this is a step that is exciting, a step that's exciting to the next exciting step. And that we keep moving the science forward for these patients who, you know, otherwise have a rare tumor that's historically poorly understood and has been hard to treat.
Decent response rate by our standards is what I'm going to quote, because I think that is very important. We are obviously the eternal optimist, but I also think it's very important. The objective response rate means 30% shrinkage. It is ridiculous to think that if your tumor shrinks by 29%, that you are not necessarily having a response. And so what I think is very decent with this study that was published, and it's published back in the Lancet Oncology in November of 2020. I think going back and looking at the waterfall plots are very good. I do this all the time when I have patients with desmoid tumors. I do it when I have patients with TGCT, because I really think the waterfall plots and a lot of the articles that have shown the rationale by which we use these drugs really highlight a bigger impact that they have. So while it's a 15% response rate, the disease control rate is much higher. And I think it's almost up to 51% of patients had some degree of shrinkage of their tumor. And so I would hate for a patient to feel that 29% shrinkage, that they're not responding and that there's something wrong with it. I also think we can't overstate the effectiveness of this because we are still stuck with a median overall survival of 19 months. So talk to me a little bit about what has happened since this drug has been evaluated, where has the company taken it in further clinical trials?
Yeah, one addition to the point that you made before, I completely agree with the waterfall plots being incredibly important, and I care more about in the in palliative setting, disease control is much more important because it is important to keep control of the disease. Shrinking a tumor by 30% does not necessarily mean that you do better than controlling the disease for a long time. And for the patients who did have any response on this trial, the duration of response was quite good, and that is, turning out to be true with many of these targeted therapies, that if you are hitting the right target, maybe you can hit that target for a long time. In terms of what those next exciting steps are, at least the this drug is currently in a clinical trial along with frontline doxorubicin, which is a first-line chemotherapeutic agent for patients with epithelioid sarcoma, trying to determine if the combination of a drug that we know that we've given these people for a long time, along with this newer drug that has some like good indication of effectiveness, can work in tandem and control disease, or even have the disease respond even better than it was shown in monotherapy in this case. I believe that the quoted response rate to doxorubicin is somewhere up to around 20%. And so you might imagine that if you combine doxorubicin and tazemetostat, you might at least get additive effect. If not, there might be some scientific rationale for synergistic effect, and hope to really, increase the number of patients who can have a meaningful response or a meaningful amount of time with their disease controlled over time, moving something up to the first line before, bad side effects happen or untoward clinical outcomes happen, so that they can really get everything that is effective for their tumor early on.
Are you concerned at all about the combined side effect profile? Or do you feel that because we've been using these drugs for a long time, that our expertise at managing side effects would allow patients to get through this without an increased toxicity level?
I am a little bit worried about the hematologic toxicity specifically, and I think that there is some thought put into that with regards to dosing, et cetera. And the other thing about these targeted therapies is that, higher dose does not always mean higher response. And so the dose response curve is not always the same with the targeted therapies as it is for something like chemotherapy. And so I would imagine in the real world, should this pan out, that there will be some, significant hematologic toxicities, but might be able to be managed with dose adjustments of either the doxorubicin or the tazemetostat, and kind of see where that comes out. It doesn't avoid that some of the other quality of life things that I had been that I was saying before about things like losing hair and the stigma of getting chemotherapy. But the thought is that, if you can control the disease for longer or be more effective, then you can give people more time and more quality that way.
Very well said. This has been extremely informative. Before we end this discussion, I'd like to get some final thoughts. So, from my perspective, I think what we've wanted to at least relay is that epithelioid sarcomas are rare. They tend to be aggressive soft tissue sarcomas. They have a over 90% likelihood of being found to have a loss of INI1 expression, which leads to an oncogenic dependence on the transcriptional repressor EZH2. And as such, we have discussed a little bit about tazemetostat, which was studied in advanced epithelioid sarcomas with loss of INI1 or SMARCB1 in an international open label phase two basket studies. We had discussed that there was a response rate of about 9%. We discussed also that with a median follow-up time of 13.8 months, the median progression-free survival was 5.5 months, and there's a median overall survival of 19 months. While we were excited about the study, we do feel that other work needs to be done in this disease, and we are encouraged by the prospect of further clinical trials looking at combination therapy of tazemetostat and chemotherapy, specifically the use of a frontline doxorubicin-based therapy. I will leave you, Daniel, to give us any last words that you'd like to discuss before we close this session.
I think that Targeted therapies like tazemetostat are very, as you mentioned and asked about the emotionality of, exciting to talk about, and exciting for our patients to extend our armamentarium of things that we can offer them for control of these, rare and difficult to treat tumors. Hopefully, we keep moving the field forward. We take this in combination, we take lessons from it and develop things for other diseases, and are able to take better care of sarcoma patients overall. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Dr. Leffler. I really appreciate you joining me today, and thank you for your contribution to this very informative discussion. We thank you for joining us and hope you found this discussion useful and informative for your patients and practice.